Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Aaron Stern, who's the director of the Academy for the Love of Learning. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Joan Logie. She is the Poet Laureate of Santa Fe. Her latest book is called The Singing Bull, published by the University of New Mexico Press. And this coming Thursday, the 21st of April, she's doing a benefit reading for the Santa Fe Girls' School, where she has been a poet for the last 11 years. It's also a celebration of her being named Poet Laureate, and that's at the Montezuma, 333 Montezuma Gallery. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So the Singing Bull is a combination of, I guess, new work and old work?
It's all new in book form. So, you know, it's been in literary magazines here and there. But when I make a manuscript and go on a track, I think of old poems. Some of them can be 20 or 30 years old that maybe never have seen the light of day. And I work on them and put them in. So most of these are fairly current, but there are a few that are, you know, older than my children.
And do you then rework them? In other words, do you find or think of a poem that you had once written, and do you then rewrite it?
Sometimes I'll fidget with it, and sometimes there's something I haven't gotten the ending, and I'll work on the ending, and I still may not be happy with the ending, but I'll put it in. I'll go for it.
Why don't we start by your reading a poem?
Okay. Some of the poems in this, well, this is a good one, How I Got Here. So it's kind of autobiographical. I got here by daughter and by rain. If I weren't a mother, would I be a train or a clarinet? Today's rain, while I talk to you on the phone about your lover and his teacher, soothes me, that rain, because I can get all knotted up in happiness. Gentle rain is my maiden name I don't use except at mantra. I don't have a sign over my beauty salon that says gentle rain. My mother hung out a shingle and cut hair, colored it blonde, platinum, or ash, honey by Revlon and Clairol. I knew them all, their stories joining the immortals. I used to be old, and then I loved children. I used to be gentle rain, and then I lived with flash flood. I never lived in North Woods or a trailer, but I've lived in Chicago and the like, San Francisco 3 years after the summer of love. I got here by cities and by dairy farm. I lived among cows 20 months, their stare and cud. They were my closest neighbors. I got here by a peace sign on a woman's black coat. That led me to you and to this place, this right now, among the losses and gunshots, the scar on my knee and the one on my belly. I got here. That was plenty. Dear right now, I want to say, dear could have been otherwise. How the tributaries of any life lead us to each other, this intersection. I got here by subway and streetcar, by atomic bomb. Los Alamos led me here, and Santa Clara Pueblo. The dancers danced me. I rode here on an old horse named Blanco. I was white. I fell fast in love. I didn't love desert. I always loved people first, and the landscape came dragging its heels.
Joan Logie. One thing I notice in reading your poems, and I've been reading the book and noticing that I just don't understand some of them, but one thing that seems pretty consistent is a lot of images. I feel like I'm watching almost quick-cutting images flash in front of me and then go away, and it's something completely different.
You're watching my mind, my restless mind.
Yeah.
The thing is, I have trouble a lot of times reading people's work on the page. It's an oral art form. So if you get to know a poet's voice, any poet, like when I read Miriam's poem, Miriam Sagan, or Robert Bly, I hear their voice embedded in the text when I read it on the page. So it's an oral form, so it's perfectly understandable that you wouldn't get it unless you read it out loud to your beloved or something, you know.
Right.
Unless it was heard.
So that makes a difference. So you read them to be read aloud. Do you read them aloud as you're writing them?
I hear them.
Yeah.
I may not say them out loud. Dylan Thomas used to, you'd walk by Dylan Thomas and you could hear him spouting his poetry, but I hear them in my head. I hear the music of them, hopefully.
Now, does poetry for you does it make a kind? Is it a kind of memoir? Because again, as you, you know, you read that one, and there's a lot of others that seem to tell bits of the stories of your life. I don't know how much of it is made up, how much of it is true. But I wondered if it was a kind of memoir.
That's a nice way to. Some of it's is memoir, like some of it's political, so it's not personal. Some of it is just, as I said, you know, watching the world around me and taking notes. I've been doing that a lot as poet laureate, going to things, just taking notes on the world. I feel like, you know, having this beautiful little gig is kind of my arranged marriage to Santa Fe, and I better pay attention to it because it's going to be over in a snap. And I want to be there.
Your arranged marriage to Santa Fe, that's a great image, particularly since a lot of these poems seem to be about marriage in one way or another. That's I guess, kind of a theme.
Yeah, well, when you've been with someone for 40 years, it tends to creep in
right.
to the material. And this book is not, I said to Michael, I wrote a book and there's nothing about you in it. Of course, he found lots, but it's not really my marriage poems. It's different.
It's not?
No.
Oh.
It's a lot, well, there's a whole section about being a grandmother. That was really challenging, because how can you write about being a grandmother without sounding like Hallmark? And I've really been struggling, like, how can I make fresh language in this old, old, ancient material and this role as grandmother? So
yeah, very, very interesting. There is a book called a poem called All My Relations, which says, I'd like to consider my marriage, for it is a... There's actually two poems that have marriage as vessel in them, and
yes.
I wanted to ask you about that. There's quite a lot of vessels in here.
Right. And there's quite a lot of poems written for particular people's marriages. But, well, it's the container. It's the form. There's forms in poetry, and one of the forms in life that people have taken on is monogamy, which I find very interesting and challenging. So, in a way, it's my spiritual path. It hasn't been easy for either of us to be together for 40 years, you know? People like, congratulations, like, you don't even know, you know. So that's why I write the poems. I take notes.
Right, right. We're talking to Joan Logie. Would you like to read another poem?
Sure. I could do a grandparent one or a marriage one.
Yeah, let's hear a grandparent one.
Okay.
Because I think that's very provocative what you said, like how to make it not sound sentimental.
We'll see how I did. So this one is written... in the voice of my grandson, Galen, before he was born. So it's a persona, and he's speaking to me. It's called Singing Down. I'm coming down out of the clouds into the rain. I hope I'm coming straight and clear. I hope I'm falling on holy ground, that the people catching me are sure and loving. I hope the people bringing me to earth have said their evening prayers and their morning prayers, because where I'm coming from is made of prayers and leaves. Silk spun from mulberry is fine, but where I'm coming from is finer still. You know those shape singers with notes so bright they drop, note by note, into your body? That's how I'm singing down, into a woman, dressed in gauzy skirts, next to a man whistling to hold up. I'm the one calling down the lullabies. I'm yours. I'm your DNA gone wild with love. I am the split second the angels take to connect us to God, my spine the ladder up and back. My feet haven't touched down yet, so learn the old songs for me, because I'll come out dazed and start forgetting. My eyes will gaze at you, and I'll lose my angel sense. Sing me to ease with an anthem from my dazzling alma mater.
Well, in my humble opinion, definitely not Hallmark.
Thank you. One could hope, although my mother was always hoping that Hallmark would hire me, actually. But
yeah, I guess that's a gig.
It's a gig.
The that poem has in it this idea of the soul waiting to be born and the soul knowing and then forgetting when it comes in. Are those Buddhist ideas? I guess you're both Jewish and Buddhist?
Well, yeah. I'm a little of everything. You know, I grew up in the wonderful time where we moved to San Francisco and we would go to Sufi dancing one night and yoga the next night and sit Zen the next night. So I think our generation had access to the world's religions in a way that never... This was pre-internet, but we did. So I'm a little of this and a little of that.
And that comes into... Because, I mean, that poem, I don't know what the theology or if it's a more of a kind of universal thing, which was also something I was thinking about. Some of the poems... I'm guessing it would help to be a close friend or relative of yours to understand them. Other ones, like this one, are kind of universal, the one you just read.
I guess I just write what what I have to write at that, you know, what's necessary to me, and I hope the reader gets it. And if they don't, if they come to a reading, I do tend to set things up and talk about it. But it is, I mean, what are our illusions? We have so many cultural references that may or not be understood. When I work with young students, which I do a lot, you know, I'm speaking a language they have no idea. I said, you know, what's the word musing mean? They don't know what musing means. So, you know, how do we establish connections between our frames of reference? And I think that's one of the challenges in poetry. And I always thought my poetry was like super duper accessible. So I'm surprised. My brother understood it. You said my brother.
But he knows you.
He does. He doesn't know me that well. He's just my brother.
Yeah, so I don't know. And of course, you know, I have my own limitations, and I mean, poetry can be difficult. We grow up reading poetry in school, and they start you out in 9th or 10th grade with Shakespeare and romantic poets, and you have no idea what's going
right.
on, and there's a kind of almost alienation that can happen if you're not led through it properly.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I feel like that's why I'm put on earth in a way, is to make poetry a delight and a joy and not a puzzle to unlock,
right.
and not something that makes us feel stupid. If you feel stupid, you may not have met that person that I call your poetry soulmate, someone that is really speaking your language. So when I work with kids, which I do all the time, that's sort of my main thing, I give them, you know, E. E. Cummings and Dylan Thomas and Naomi Shihab Nye, all, you know, a big range of poetry. One of my students fell in love with the Harlem Renaissance poet Langston Hughes. She couldn't get enough of Langston Hughes. And it was fascinating, and her poems were influenced. So that's what I do. I'm excited about this reading on Thursday. Some of the 8th graders from Santa Fe Girls' School are going to join me. They have honored me, and they're going to read some of their poems. And I actually have permission from one of the 8th graders, Sarah Nuama, to read a poem of hers.
Oh, can we do that?
Yes, and hopefully she'll be there. But there'll be about a half dozen girls. It's called A Saint of a Saint. She is a saint of saints from a family of saints. A saint who picks dead flowers, who walks in the rain, who watches people spiral down, 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 until they have nothing left, and she doesn't help them. Yes, she is a saint. A saint who doesn't move when people walk her way and doesn't do what she's asked. A saint who never speaks. She is a saint who dirties the snow and ripples the water. A saint who cries at happy times and smiles at sad ones. A saint indeed. She is a saint who dances on the edge of the fire pit, and one who does not bury the dead. She is a saint that did not pay for the apple she just took. She is a saint that throws her trash to the ground, a saint who blows out the candles in the church, a saint that sings off tune, who swims against the current, and a saint who tears the pages out of books. Oh, yes, she is a saint, but a saint who wasn't taught what saints do best. Be a saint. Sarah Nuama.
So this is one of
your
students.
This is 8th graders. Yeah, I have 11 years of their books. We make a book every year, and the 8th graders get 2 pages, and the 6th and 7th get 1. And we're going to display all the books so people can see the work. To be in a school for 3 years with the girls through 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and to have this 11-year history, thanks to the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, deep thanks, it's practically unheard of.
Yeah.
So I feel so lucky, And if they could see how bad my writing was at their age and how good theirs is, I mean, it's amazing how good they are.
And they've got some guidance. I mean, what you said a moment ago, people finding their soulmates, their some poet from history or contemporary poet who speaks to their hearts in a certain way. When you make that connection, it's kind of like being a matchmaker.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah, and I send them off with a list of poets, local poets, old poets, new poets, and say, find one, and have them memorize a poem and then write in the style of a poet. And, you know, we try. Not everyone's going to. But I've had girls say, you have no idea, poetry saved my life. And I know some of my old students are in graduate school in poetry, which totally thrills me.
Amazing.
You know? Yeah, it's true.
Now, who are your own poetic soulmates?
Well, I have some odd loves. I have to drop a name. My dear Pittsburgher, I'm from Pittsburgh, Gerald Stern, who's in his 80s, called me last week because I dedicated some poems to him in my book and sent him the book, and he called me, and I had to say to a friend, excuse me, I'm on call waiting. Gerald Stern's on call waiting. I've got to go talk to him. I love him. And another, Jack Gilbert's another Pittsburgher, and Linda Gregg, And my local friends, Rene Gregorio, Miriam Sagan, my peers are very important to me. I've grown with them. I've known them for 20-some years. And I think we learn from, you know, our peer group without having to reach to somebody that really doesn't need to get a letter from you, to have friends that are there.
And influencing the way you think and the way you write and the way you are in community.
Definitely. I think we have just a brilliant poetry community, both audience and producing poets here. I think it's very unusual. I had a friend from back east who said, you know, it's as good as New York. You know, there's things going on. Like, there could be two or three things a night in poetry.
Extraordinary.
It's incredible. Yeah.
Now, some of your poems are really tied to place. I mean, you live here in New Mexico. You've lived here for a really long time. But let's see. You, Joan Logie, are newly poet laureate. What are your, duties for the next 2 years?
Well, my poet laureateness goes until June 2012. I've made 3 public appearances, mostly with the mayor, where I give a poem that I've written for the occasion. I did 5, it's called Joan and the Giant Pencil, where I have a program with musician Jeremy Blyke, and we go into the schools and I show kids how I fell in love with poetry, and he's composed music to poems from my childhood up through Robert Frost and current poets, and we give that for an audience of 30 to 100 kids. And so I did 6 performances this year. There'll be 6 next year. So public performances as well as things in the schools. And then at the very end of the whole shebang, there will be an art fused with poetry invitational at the community gallery, which is connected to the convention center. So that'll be probably April, May of next year. And that'll be my sort of last hurrah. So that'll be a big project.
You had, as you mentioned a moment ago, some students who said that poetry saved their lives. What about you?
You know, I loved poetry so much. In high school, I was very private about it. I had one best friend, and I would share it with one person.
So you would write poems and not show them to anybody but her?
Right. I did get one. I won a prize. I got things published, but I was very private. So I'm very honored when my students will get up and do this with me and for me. It just means so much, because I know it's hard. It has saved me many a time. It's where I turn in extremis. That's where I have that, and I've, you know.
What does that look like? I mean, when you say
it looks
saved
like
you.
I could be, you know, at some point we didn't have computer. I just had a typewriter in the corner of the living room, and my family would be, you know, 3 children would be bouncing off the walls, and I would just like swivel my chair and write a poem in the middle of it all. Or if I was having a fight with my beloved or whatever it was, you know, I feel like it's a tool. You know, some people resort to alcohol or violence, and I have the vessel that we talked about. I have this thing that can contain emotional energy, and that's a product, and that just feels like a way to deal with the human condition. I don't know if that answers your question. So,
yeah.
You know, I wasn't a prison poem like our beloved Jimmy Baca, who is so brilliant, and I loved hearing
his poem. Yeah. Saved his life.
That's what I'm saying.
Literally.
That's what I'm saying. I wasn't that extreme.
Right.
But we all have human challenges, and so.
And we all, I mean, I think the thing, whether or not it's a literal saving of your life, there is this thing which is basically shutting down, turning off the switch, deciding not to deal with something, going into denial, whatever you want to call it, choosing to do that or not do it. And if poetry is a way not to do it, a way to actually express whatever those things are, then it's probably performing a social function.
Right.
Of some kind.
And when everyone's brave and kind of steps out of the comfort, people come up to you afterwards that you don't know and say, oh, thank you for doing that. So I have some other brave things that I haven't published yet, but hopefully after this poet laureate is over, then I go back to some other materials.
How did you choose the name The Singing Bowl? That's the name of your newest book of poetry.
Yes. Well, when I teach, I always use a singing bowl to start the writing.
What's a singing bowl?
Singing bowl, my daughter brought me from Nepal. It's a hammered brass bowl with a wooden and you can make it sing like a wine glass, or you can strike it like a bell, which is what I use it in teaching. And then I got the image of the child being born, this first grandchild, the act of birth, and just the reverberations of a grandchild in my life. And I dedicated the book to my three grandchildren. Because they're my mother say, they're my dividends of my stock. So I think more reverberation.
Oh no, what a metaphor.
I know, my mother was a businesswoman. But, you know, I think of that bowl, just the vessel is so sacred, and the bowl of the earth. And I don't know, it just had that feeling for me. And then I found this gorgeous cover art, which I'm so happy with, Jitsudo Anchieta. I hope you'll see the book.
Yeah. Well, it's published by the University of New Mexico Press, and it's called The Singing Bowl. Joan Logie is poet laureate for the next couple of years here in Santa Fe. And once again, on Thursday, the 21st of April, she will be doing a reading, which is a benefit for the Santa Fe Girls' School, where she is poet in residence, has been doing that for the last 11 years. I love that you have 11 years worth of these young people's books, which will be on display. It's at 333 Montezuma. It's a gallery right there on the corner of Montezuma and Guadalupe at 6 o'clock in the evening. And your website is thepoemdifferent.blogspot.com. And so you've got other events upcoming as well.
I have things all over the place. And if you go to that blog, I will update the latest dates for you.
Joan Logie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm happy now to welcome to the program Aaron Stern. He is the founder and director of the Academy for the Love of Learning. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, the Academy for the Love of Learning, what's it all about? What was your inspiration to found this organization?
The inspiration was a deep disappointment in the way we go about educating our children, and wanting to find a way that would be more holistic, to use language that I think is common parlance. And I just know that we're barely tapping the potential that sits in us as human beings through formal education. And by that I mean grade school and elementary school, you know, through high school. And I felt that it was important to begin to re-examine some of the basic assumptions that we have about what learning is meant to be about, and what kind of human beings are we trying to become, and how does education serve that?
What are some of the basic assumptions that you're questioning?
Well, is education about getting a job? That would be about the most basic of the assumptions. And I have a strong knowing that understanding and who I am as a human being, and why am I here, and what is it to be a human being, are very deep fundamental questions that we all ask. Who am I? Why am I here? And I feel that education should be shaped around those kinds of questions. And right now, the way they're shaped essentially are around getting jobs.
Who am I? Why am I here? Those are, in a lot of ways, kind of theological questions.
They're right on the edge, yes.
Yeah. I mean,
well, that's where we position them, I would say.
Yeah.
But actually, the longing to find meaning in life is not theological. It's actually very personal, and it's very common. And I think the loss of heart that we experience as human beings when we're in an absence of meaning, it may, in the end, be somehow relegated to theological pursuit, but actually it's actually very day-to-day, mundane. How do I get up out of bed and find something to do that I care about?
So, what is the process by which you help people along this path?
Well, it's a combination of unlearning, because unfortunately we're so conditioned not to look inward and listen to what I might call my deepest voice. It's like, what do I really feel and believe about something? The conditioning is so strong in the what one would call introjects, the social introjects, the cultural introjects.
What's introjects?
Oh, things that are kind of planted in us, as things that we ought to think and ought to believe. So there's a great distance sometimes between what we feel and know and what we think is the way things are. So I think that that gap and that distance becomes a very important thing to address, and it becomes something that we can actually, let's say, dismantle that gap and get closer to what I would call our deepest voices.
Tell us an example of what that process has looked like, either for you or for some of the students whom you've worked with.
Well, I think most important it's slowing down. We're all in these habitual responses to our environment all the time. It all happens so quickly that we don't really have the time to reflect on what we're doing. So a lot of our work begins with slowing down and stepping into reflection. And we do that in the company of others, and we also do that individually. Another thing that we do a lot of is get into the body. Somatic experience is really important to our work because actually the mind, we have these exquisite things sitting on our shoulders, these brains, and very often we're rehashing material. We're just spinning it back and forth and around and around and around, and we're looking for fresh insight, fresh information, and actually it's stored in the body. So getting into our feet, feeling our feet on the ground, which sounds really kind of simple and common, it's actually not. So what does it take to step into the experience of sensation in the body more fully and feel more fully some of the feelings that we're feeling and learn to embrace them and to recognize what the messages are that are in them? What are the needs that are wrapped up in them? Often a disassociation from some of our basic needs is something that we see very often.
What are some of those basic needs we're disassociated from?
Oh, my gosh, safety, the need for intimacy. And I mean, not physical intimacy, but intimate contact with other human beings. The need to slow down and gather our thoughts and form a response more thoughtfully. A need to let register the impact of the... I mean, if you think about what's happened in the last 6 months in this world, I don't know whether to think about the Gulf oil spill or do I think about Japan. Well, I mean, what do I really register and allow to have a full impact on me such that I can come with a creative response that's deep from within?
It's tricky because... Of course, we evolved in very small bands and clans and tribes and groups, maybe 40, 50 people, maybe 200 people,
right.
Or primates, however far back you want to go. And so even conceptualizing a world of 6 billion people is in some instinctual way beyond our grasp.
Yes, I would agree. And it's interesting you say that because our work is so intimate. I mean, we just built this beautiful new home for ourselves in Seton Village, and it's gorgeous, but it's actually very small. The rooms are small and intimate because we scale small. We're not looking to scale massive. We're looking to rehumanize ourselves, and intimate relationships and contact and taking the time. I'd like to just give an example. I'm a musician, a pianist, and one of the things that I learned very early in my life is that if you make a mistake and you learn a piece the wrong way, it takes so much work to get it corrected. So if I'm very rapidly playing a Chopin etude or whatever it is that I might be playing, I remember Margaret Nichols, my piano teacher, when I was about 12 years old, saying, do you realize that in the third measure, on the second page, you know, I don't remember exactly, but that you're playing a wrong note. And I said, oh, I know, Mrs. Nichols, but my God, there's like 10 million notes in this piece, and I just want to hear it. I want to play it. And she said, well, all right, if you want to play it the wrong way. And I said, okay, you got me. And she said, do you know how to change it? And I said, not exactly. And she said, well, here's what you have to do. You have to slow your fingers down so slowly just before you're going to play the wrong note. And you have to slow them down enough to so that your brain can tell your finger to play the other note. And then you'll begin to hear it differently. And then as you practice it the correct way a few more times, you can begin to speed it back up and you've changed the pattern. Well, that's been a very important touchstone for me in all of my work. I mean, the slowing down and looking at what we're doing and making a different choice and actually feeling our feeling response to that choice and being guided by something internally is part of all of our work.
It sounds, if I may say so, like therapy, like psychotherapy.
Well, I think sometimes therapeutic issues do come up for people, but I don't see it that way at all. In fact, we've positioned all of our work in the context of learning because I would say it's more about habilitation than rehabilitation. We haven't learned these skills in the first place.
Well, but you're unlearning a bunch of skills, as you said.
You are, but the gravitational pull to the other, to what I would call a it's like a corrective, maybe the way I would say it. The gravitational pull is so strong to that. I think it's actually more natural to us. I think it heralds back to the way it once was, as you were describing earlier, smaller bands, more contact, more connection. I think that's more natural to us. Now, along the way, there may be therapeutic issues like, oh, my God, well, what's going to happen if I don't go fast, and produce? Then maybe you have to go to a therapist and help you adjust and make the kinds of life changes that may be required, and that might be hard.
I'm always a little bit skeptical when I hear anything that smacks of the way it once was better, because we come from, I mean, violent warring bands as well as what you might call noble ceremonial people, whatever your mythology is about the good old days, whether they be 5,000 years ago or a century ago. I mean, we're not a very nice species.
No, never were. Maybe never will be. No, I would agree with that.
We're talking to Aaron Stern, founder and director of the Academy for the Love of Learning. Now, your mentor was Leonard Bernstein.
Yes.
Tell us about your relationship with him, how you met him, and how you worked with him.
I first met him in 1971, on my honeymoon, actually, and at the Kennedy Center, at the opening of the Kennedy Center, and he had been commissioned by the Kennedy family to write a piece for the opening in commemoration of the life of John F. Kennedy. And he wrote a mass. Well, he wrote a piece called Mass. It wasn't actually a mass. And it was a theater piece for singers and dancers and musicians and actors. So I met him backstage, and he looked at me and he said, "Do I know you?" And I said, "No." I was then 21, I think. And he said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I'm positive." And he said, "Well, I don't know who you are, but I'm sure that I love you." And he took me in one arm and my wife in his other arm, and we wended our way through the bowels of the Kennedy Center and landed in this amazing room. And he insisted that we stay and join him for dinner. And this was the big gala opening, dinner. So I sat next to Gregory Peck, and my wife across from me sat next to Barbara Walters.
Good
and
heavens.
We were like in Wonderland. So that's how I first met him.
What was that all about?
God knows. I still don't know. But it continued. It was some 7 years later. I re-met him, and by then I was the dean of a college of music in Chicago, and I was invited to a dinner to meet Leonard Bernstein, because I was told, this was in New York, I was told that a lot of my work then, which was curriculum development about getting into what I now call deepest voice, but the unique expression of each student versus the kind of factory mind, which is playing major and minor scales and arpeggios at 288 on a metronome, and there's no music, it's just mechanical. So I think that was the very beginning of my work in thinking about education and how to tap into the deeply original part of each of us. So at that dinner with Bernstein some 7 or so years later, he became quite interested and excited about my work, and that formed this relationship that went on through the last decade of his life. I was with him the night before he died. So he's the one who came with the name of the Academy. And so he was deeply committed to this work and helped me enormously over the course of the last decade of his life.
The relationship in music, and I think this can be extrapolated to so many areas, mm-hmm. between craft and that deep feeling is something that everybody has to work with. I mean, you have to learn that craft, and to some extent it is mechanical.
No, it's never mechanical. I'm sorry. But what you just said is beautiful, the craft and the deep personal expression. That's what I think the Academy is about. It's, yes, we have to craft our lives, but it's our individual lives that we're trying to craft. And I do see there are deep original impulses in each person. And the bringing those into form and bringing those into, if you like the word craft, I think it's a fine word, but crafting our lives such that we're manifesting the depth of who we are as human beings. Everybody longs for that. we long for that authenticity and that originality, and the world desperately needs it. I really believe that.
Now, you are teaching this course. It's a two-year course, and this coming Thursday, the 28th of April at 6 o'clock, there's an open house. We'll tell you about that in a moment. People can find out more information. But it's called Learning by Being.
No, Leading by Being.
Leading by Being. Mm-hmm. What's it all about? What I mean, 2 years. What do people do? What does it look like?
Well, they unlearn and they learn. And it's very much about getting into clearing away the obstacles to a deep expression of what we would call authentic or free self. And it's divided into three phases or three modules, and there are 10 sessions over 2 years, spread out over every couple of months. And the we work with three basic questions. In the first module or phase, we work with the question, who am I? And we look at it from three different perspectives. We look at what we would call constructed self or personality. We would look at it from the perspective of free self, which is less conditioned. And we look at it from the perspective of no self, which is a contemplative meditative point of view. And we actually know that all three of those aspects of self live in all of us. So we're not advocating any one over the other. More what we're doing is trying to find the freedom to come and go between these places of self, let's say.
Right.
So that's the first module. The second one is called Who Are We? And that one is very much about group connection and who are we in the company of each other and how do we bring the qualities of self forward, and particularly the what I would call free self or deepest voice, into the context of a group so that we can meet each other from a group, from individual to group, and learn what it is to be in a group in a very different way than I believe we are accustomed in our contemporary culture. And we call it, it's very based in learning. What have we to do with each other? Why is it we've been drawn together? What is the depth of capacity that we may have as a group for intimacy, for learning, deep learning from each other, be changed by each other? How can we actually become vulnerable in the face of each other? So we practice many, many skills in that context.
When I think about the groups that really could use some of that, I think of, for example, Congress, mm-hmm. or various political groups, whether they be city councils on a local level or you know, even in military groups and so on, and the cultures of those groups. And when I think about how little productive work actually gets done on the highest level politically, those cultures are kind of antithetical to the things that, mm-hmm. that you're saying. So it's great if you can lead by being within a group of like-minded people or people who are open to those ideas. But when you really get into these other cultures that are so much about power and ego, yes. What happens? I mean, are those?
Well, what do you think happens?
Well, I mean, I haven't gone through your course. I don't know what it's like, but I would think that whether I had gone into it or not, I'd never want to even be in those in the first place. So the good people stay out.
Well, no, actually what I find is it doesn't matter how good I think I am, I have issues around power. So they're not actually in Congress. They're actually right here in this body and in my mind. And I think that's true for all of us. So the negotiation and navigation of power and the meetings at the boundary of one human being to another is something that lives right here, and that capacity has to be practiced and developed here. That's one thing I would say about it. So, for example, in the group module, we work with scapegoating complexes. And what is this human tendency to scapegoat? I hate to use that as a verb, but I will. What is that human tendency? How do we actually engage in that activity, and how do we rise up from that? What are the other options and possibilities? The other thing I'd say about politics
is... Can you answer that question? What are the other possibilities?
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, it has to do with, it's again back to the piano metaphor. As soon as I start talking about somebody else, stop for a moment and ask, what's the motivation here? You know, why am I doing this? What am I afraid of? What is the energy that's moving in me that's trying to diminish another human being? What is the need? Where is that coming from? Can I actually develop some self-control around that? So that's what we learn to do in a group context. And, oh, dear. It's not done yet, but it's a different practice in understanding what that kind of activity is part of it. It's to me, education means to lead or guide out. That's one version of the definition of education. And how can we guide out, you know, our better nature as human beings? I mean, we know how to do the other part. The other thing I just want to say about politics and is that William Irwin Thompson, who comes here fairly often, wrote a wonderful piece about describing how culture works. And he talks about the artists and the mystics who have these planetary perceptions first. And then the business people begin to market them and become entrepreneurs with them. And then ultimately the politicians legislate them. So actually they're the last on the list, to be honest with you. And there's power in many other places in our culture. And the last thing I'd say to you is I'm just thinking about a wonderful book called The Shadow Culture. And this book really talks about how historically, going back to, it goes way back in American culture, but it's also world culture, there's always on the periphery catalysts and change agents that are actually seeking and even have the responsibility to the center to bring change. That's our job. And so actually it's not about necessarily changing politicians, but it's actually creating models that work and examples of human behavior that can function in a different way, and more it begins to influence the center. And I think that's partly my answer to your question. The rest will happen, you know, kind of through the magical forces of life.
We're talking to Aaron Stern from the Academy for the Love of Learning. So in addition to the leading by being, you're also doing a summer program for teachers in Santa Fe Public Schools.
Correct.
What's that all about?
Well, we have a teacher renewal project that's actually been going on totally for 7 years, but in the last 3 years in Santa Fe. The teacher renewal project brings together teachers in the public schools, all grades, and they come together for weekend workshops in the fall. They have three of them. In the spring, they have three of them. And it's very much focused on self-renewal, getting back in touch with the call to teach and what that was about. And also the ennobling of the teaching profession and the support of the deepest processes of learning, so that learning itself becomes a practice for teachers instead of teaching to a test being the practice of teachers. It's a very different orientation. So through they come for those workshops, then they actually go into peer-to-peer circles that they work with monthly out of that, and then it culminates with the Summer Institute each summer. And that's what that program is about. And we've, I think, had is approximately 150 educators, teachers in the public schools who have been part of it. And it's said to be the most popular program in their continuing education series. So it's a wonderful, wonderful program. And it will take place now, finally, in our new center, which is beautiful. We have beautiful land, and it's a very beautiful place.
In Seton Village.
In Seton Village, yes. It's gorgeous. It's just a beautiful place.
So what do the teachers actually do in this workshop with each other, with you, the staff of the academy?
Many of the same things we do in Leading by Being, but in a shorter period of time. A part of it is finding a clarity about aspirations and distinct flavors of teachers and philosophies of teaching and learning. We do many kinds of physical-based exercises so people get out of their minds a little bit and into their bodies. We did a beautiful mask-making process the last time, last summer, where teachers really defined a particular learning edge or aspiration that they have for themselves that they would work with through the coming year. You know, the learning spirit itself is natural in all of us. Listen to all your questions. We're full of curiosity and full of questions. And the learning spirit itself, no matter what else is happening in those classrooms, if children can feel teachers in learning mode, it will infect them with learning mode. And no matter what happens, if that happens, we have what we need to make our way through life. So I think the Teacher Renewal Summer Institutes are about the renewing of the commitment to learning and being models of active learning beings.
I had
one teacher, well, I had some very nice teachers, but there's one person in the fourth grade who was that. And it's fascinating to me how just one teacher in 12 years can give you what you need. They don't all have to be that way.
That's right. That's right. And the more the merrier.
Right.
We live in difficult times. And yeah, so it's very important that we do everything that we can to support the teachers in the schools. And boy, you see what's happening all over the country. We're in this impossible situation. We're in a mechanical, industrial age school model. You know, the doors open, the bells ring, the kids move out, they move to the next. It's a mechanical.
Yeah, it's a factory
it's
model.
It's a factory model. And so what can
and
we.
And it's also a prison model.
It's a prison model, too. You're absolutely right. So what can we do in the midst of all of that that honors the deep call to teach that lives in so many of our teachers and administrators in the schools and just bring our humanity forward? That's what touches children. Look what you just remembered. You know, all the other ones sort of disappear, but how do we...
Oh, I remember them all, believe you me.
But the ones you remember fondly are those.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron, so you were talking before about your mentor, Leonard Bernstein. And when I think about him and his incredible love for you, a complete stranger when he met you, for young people, for music, for life itself, how did he get that way?
Well, I think one thing I will say is I think we all have a dose of that. Some of us a little bit more, maybe some of it, some of us a little bit less. So he was born that way.
So he was just on fire, and the fire was never put out.
No, not until he died. Yeah. But what I would also say to you is that the kind of the motivating question that gave birth to the Academy, because he was my co-conceiver of the Academy, was the question, don't we never learn? And, you know, he was a great liberal, Bernstein, and he had such high hopes and felt that... that the human capacity to learn was going to bring us out of the misery we're in. And I share that. I actually believe that if you take the lid off learning, we will learn ourselves to a better world and a better life. So that takes a lot of work, and the Academy is focused on that very deeply. I think I'd like to, maybe I'm not answering your question. I think this is what news people do, you know. They interview people, and then the people answer the question they really want to answer. I think that's the way it's supposed to work. I'd like to just say to you that for the Academy has a lot of different programs. We've talked about a couple of them here, but we have many programs. What's at the center of the Academy is transformative learning. We believe that human beings long to transform to become better human beings and to become better at being human beings, whatever that might mean. And so we feel that transformative learning and the processes of transformative learning are central to that. So all of our programs, though they may look very different, have at the center certain methods that really transform and wake us up as human beings. And that's what we're actually studying. We're kind of like a Santa Fe Institute for Education and educational methods and processes. And some people call us a think and do tank. Mm-hmm. Other people call us an inquiry and action tank. We're not a tank. We're 86 acres of beautiful land and a beautiful new home.
Right.
But we are always reflecting on what we're doing, learning about how to become better at teaching and learning, and sharing those methodologies as broadly as we can.
Aaron Stern is the founder and director of the Academy for the Love of Learning. They are on the web at aloveoflearning.org, and you can call at 505-995-1860. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.